KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump tries again to cut foreign aid. The White House already paused a lot of it with effects around the world. Now he's asking Congress to take back aid it previously approved. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The president also asked Congress to take back money it already approved for public broadcasting. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Why has an American-led group put on hold its food distribution in Gaza? We'll tell you what we know about a shooting nearby. Also, Republicans are divided over artificial intelligence. Why are some concerned? And a Navy SEAL turned doctor turned astronaut talks of the power of believing in yourself. Remember that, Layla?
I believe.
It's Wednesday, June 4th. This day in 1919, Congress approved the 19th Amendment, which was meant to assure women the right to vote. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Pentagon may rename ships and installations that honor civil rights leaders. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports that includes the U.S. Navy ship Harvey Milk, named for the slain gay rights leader.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered an internal review, according to his spokesman, to make sure names of ships and bases reflect President Trump's priorities. But a U.S. official who was not authorized to speak tells NPR Hegseth has already directed the Navy to remove Harvey Milk's name from the ship that has honored him since 2016. Milk served in the Navy and later became one of the country's leading gay rights leaders. He was assassinated in 1978. The official said the review includes ships named for civil rights pioneers Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Thurgood Marshall, and Medgar Evers, suffragist Lucy Stone, labor leaders Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez, and even Harriet Tubman, who freed enslaved people and led Union troops during the Civil War. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The Senate is reviewing the multi-trillion-dollar spending package backed by President Trump. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports tucked away in the bill is a provision on artificial intelligence that's dividing some Republican members.
In the bill the House passed, there's a provision that says that most laws about artificial intelligence that states have passed will be paused for 10 years. Republicans in favor of the provision say there's inconsistency in how states have addressed AI protections, and they don't want limits on AI innovation as the U.S. competes with China over the technology. But if state laws are paused, then there are virtually no legal protections against potential abuses of AI. Congress has been debating over passing federal regulation for years, but still hasn't acted. Republican senators like Missouri's Josh Hawley and Tennessee's Marsha Blackburn have vocally opposed the provision as the upper body deliberates. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
A Democrat on the House Oversight Committee is demanding answers from Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. He wants to know why employees fired by the Commerce Department were denied health care coverage for which they had already paid. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, some employees are facing thousands of dollars in medical bills.
The committee's acting top Democrat Stephen Lynch sent Lutnick a letter after hearing from fired Commerce Department employees. Hundreds were fired as part of the Trump administration's purge of more recent hires, then reinstated under court order, then fired again in mid-April when an appeals court lifted that order. Belatedly, the employees were told that their health care coverage had ended in early April, 2 days before they were fired the second time, even though they'd been continuously paying their health insurance premiums through their paychecks. Now Lynch wants to know why the Commerce Department has not honored its commitment to provide 31 days of health care coverage following a termination and refunded the premiums employees paid. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up more than 70 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Trump administration has revoked a Biden-era requirement that hospitals give emergency abortions to women in danger of their lives. That also included states where abortion is outlawed. But there is a federal law still on the books requiring hospitals to provide emergency reproductive care. So it's not clear if the Trump administration is instructing hospitals to turn away women in medical emergencies. Closing arguments continue today in the sex crimes retrial of former movie producer Harvey Weinstein. New York prosecutors will finish summing up their arguments today. Weinstein is being retried after New York's top court overturned his earlier conviction. His California convictions on sexual assault stand. Today, Vietnam has announced an end to its decades-long limit of two children per family. Ashish Valentine reports The move comes as Vietnam joins several other Asian nations struggling with low birth rates and population decline.
Similar to China's one-child policy, families in Vietnam used to face penalties if they had more than two children. China officially ended its one-child policy almost a decade ago when it realized its population was aging rapidly. Vietnam's now doing the same after its birth rate fell below the population replacement level a couple years in a row. But raising the birth rate once it falls has been tough throughout Asia. Vietnam's only the latest country to have to figure out how to deal with this increasingly global problem. For NPR News, I'm Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
Again on Wall Street, the Dow is now up 68 points. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldil. Good morning. The Trump administration has formally asked Congress to take back money for foreign aid and public media.
The president would like Congress to vote down money that it previously voted up. $8 billion are for the U.S. Agency for International Development. $1.1 billion is set aside to support the next 2 years of public broadcasting, mainly local stations, such as the one you're hearing now. The process of taking back the money is called rescission. Congress has 45 days to approve these requests or let them die. NPR covers itself like anybody else, so we will give you the facts, and no NPR newsroom or corporate executives had any input into this story.
Joining us now is NPR correspondent Fatima Tanis. Good morning, Fatima.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so let's start with this request to defund public broadcasting. What can you tell us?
So this is part of the president's broader clash with major cultural institutions, as my colleague David Folkenflik has been reporting over the last few months. Now, the president and his Republican allies have accused NPR and PBS of partisan bias. President Trump issued an executive order last month that would defund both organizations. NPR CEO Catherine Marr has said that the administration is punishing public media for coverage that the president dislikes, and both NPR and PBS are challenging that order in court. Now, the White House is asking Congress to officially cancel all the funding it has set aside for the public broadcasters over the next two fiscal years. That's the $1.1 billion. It's a fraction of the overall federal budget. In statements yesterday, the heads of NPR and PBS outlined the serious impact that losing that funding would have on their stations that reach Americans all over the country.
And what do they say those implications would be?
Well, they said that it would be, quote, devastating, and especially to local public media stations in rural communities that would be disproportionately harmed.
And what about that $8 billion in foreign aid that the White House wants to send back to the Treasury? What are those funds for?
So they fund global health programs aimed at controlling the spread of diseases like HIV/AIDS. The White House is cutting $400 million for that. Millions of dollars also in contributions to the World Health Organization, various United Nations agencies. Now, in the memo that the White House sent to Congress, it says some of the funds have been used for, quote, radical projects, and that the cuts are part of an effort to, quote, eliminate wasteful foreign assistance programs.
I mean, Fatima, you've been on this program a lot talking about the way the administration effectively dismantled USAID. So why is the White House sending these requests to Congress now?
Yes, you may remember that the agency was the first to see mass staffing cuts, termination to its programs. Effectively, it's been shut down. All of that was done without congressional approval, and there have been several lawsuits where the president's power to withhold funds without congressional approval has been challenged. There's no ruling on this yet. I spoke with Jonathan Katz. He's the senior director of anti-corruption, democracy, and security at the Brookings Institution. He sees this request as a sign that the administration is hitting walls in its efforts to dismantle federal agencies.
I think part of the losses that the administration is seeing in the courts may be impacting how they think they need to approach issues, including congressional funding or reorganizing government. They need to go to Congress to do these things.
So this is the legal avenue for the administration to codify the cuts it has already made, and there will likely be more rescission requests for all the other budget cuts the president wants to see happen across the federal government.
That's NPR's Fatima Tanis. Thank you, Fatima.
Thank you.
Lawmakers called to vote on the rescission include Democrat Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, who's on both relevant committees, Foreign Affairs and Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Steve.
So I want to ask some bottom line questions here. On foreign aid first, we've documented on NPR that pausing the aid already affected a lot of people overseas. Some people died. But part of the case against this aid is it's not America's business, not America's problem, what happens overseas. So tell me, in your view, what is our interest in paying for health clinics or AIDS drugs for Africa, for example?
Steve, I worked in global health for many years before coming to Congress, and I think that this has always been in America's interest for us to make sure that we are addressing the spread of global diseases that cross borders, making sure that we're investing and helping people to be healthy in those countries, and at the same time using sort of what's called our soft power to help governments around the world and to build relationships and partnerships. The funding that this rescission package is cutting is critical to the health and safety of people around the world. There are some researchers that estimate that over 300,000 people have already died just in 4 months as a result of the USAID cuts to humanitarian assistance, to PEPFAR, which is HIV/AIDS prevention. And so this is just bad on all accounts. And I would just say it's a tiny, tiny fraction. The entire package is a tiny fraction of what we actually spend at the federal budget.
That is true. I guess public broadcasting is an even tinier fraction. But let me ask a bottom line question about that. This money fundamentally goes to local stations. It provides a lot of local news, including on the station we're hearing now. But there are other points of view about this. I talk with a conservative radio host. I think he sees public broadcasting as competition, doesn't like subsidized competition in his view, in addition to disagreeing with what he sees as bias. What would you say to him?
Well, the attack on public broadcasting is a direct attack on free press in this country, because this is the way in which we ensure that 99% of Americans have access to emergency alerts, to local programming, to weather reports. That all comes through these public broadcasting stations. And I would just say that out of the grants, which are about 70% of the funding, 245 of the total 544 radio and TV grantees are considered rural. These are stations that have a harder time raising outside dollars. And by the way, it's $1.60 per American that goes to fund this public good, which is called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Just got about 30 seconds left. I want to ask one other question. This is part of a debate over spending. There's this larger House budget bill that essentially doesn't address federal debt. It actually increases federal borrowing that my kids are supposed to pay back. In fairness, though, when Democrats were in the majority, you also borrowed trillions of dollars. So in about 20 seconds or so, do you believe it is necessary somehow soon to limit federal borrowing?
Well, I think that Democrats have always invested in things that return multiple times over. And that's the question. Are we investing in things that are going to help local businesses and economies? Or are you giving tax breaks to the wealthiest? And that's what the big bad betrayal bill of the Republicans is doing, is giving a tax cut to the wealthiest people in this country. And that is not going to help our economy. And it is not going to help ensure that we undermine national debt in the long term.
But the debt needs to come down. About 5 seconds here.
I think, of course, we always want to cut debt as much as possible. But the question is really about what we invest in.
Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
A private U.S. group running food distribution sites in Gaza says it has put its operations on hold today. That's after another deadly shooting occurred near its site yesterday, killing 27 Palestinians, according to hospitals and health officials in Gaza.
As with so much else about this war, there are conflicting accounts of what happened. Israeli military officials say the troops fired warning shots, quote, near a few individual suspects, but Israel says they did not fire at crowds. Airstrikes continued overnight in Gaza as Israel expands its military campaign and continues to restrict aid into the enclave.
With me now is NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi in Tel Aviv for the latest. Good morning, Hadil.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, the rollout of this aid distribution has been deadly, and that's not just yesterday. What can you tell us about the operations of this U.S. group?
Well, nearly every day since the group started operations more than a week ago, Gaza health officials have told us that dozens of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli gunfire near sites run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. Israel, of course, denies this. But because of this, the United Nations has called aid delivery today in Gaza a, quote, death trap. Today, GHF said they would take a, quote, one-day pause in activity. In a statement, organizers said that the sites need to prepare logistically with the Israeli military to deal with the size of the crowds arriving. They said they didn't expect 15,000 people in 1 hour to show up yesterday. I mean, it seems that the GHF didn't know how many Palestinians are sheltering close by or how many were willing to walk miles to get the food because of their desperation. And then yesterday, GHF appointed a U.S. evangelical leader, Reverend Dr. Johnny Moore, as its executive chairman. You know, before GHF started operating, the head of the group, Jake Wood, resigned. He said that the group was unable to operate according to humanitarian principles. And then the GHF says it is aware that the Israeli military is investigating casualties, but despite Israel's admission, troops fired near the site. Reverend Moore posted on social media that the shootings are a lie.
So is that assertion true? I mean, what are we hearing from Gaza?
I mean, first of all, remember that Palestinians have been under a total blockade for nearly 3 months. So people are very hungry, desperate. They're swarming the GHF sites. It's been chaotic. And we've talked to people who say they storm the sites, they grab however many boxes they can. They also tell us that they leave empty-handed. And there are the shootings. You know, we have heard from doctors in hospitals say that they're receiving victims. For example, we spoke to Ahmed Abu Swaid. He's a doctor volunteering from Australia at Nasser Hospital in Gaza. Here's what he had to say.
The basic supplies that you do have are dwindling, and they're consuming them at a rapid rate because of the sheer volume of mass casualty events that come through this hospital.
So he says that the hospital just can't keep up with the number of people getting shot and injured in those sites or around those sites.
And you mentioned that Israel denies shooting into the crowds. What other things have they said about these incidents?
Well, yesterday, the Israeli foreign minister, the PMO, and the Israeli military all held press conferences. Their messages were the same. They say that they've repeated throughout the week that the multiple deadly shootings are exaggerated and hyped up by the media.
NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Hadil.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the face-off between Harvard University and the Trump administration. We talk with Harvard law professor Noah Feldman. The administration has frozen around $3 billion in Harvard grants and contracts and is trying to stop the university's ability to enroll foreign students. In response, Harvard is suing. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Remember when you were little at school and you were asked what you wanted to be when you grew up? You might have heard answers like doctor, astronaut, Navy SEAL. For some people, one of those would be enough. Johnny Kim has been all three. And right now, he's in orbit hundreds of miles above us.
Houston, this is Station. I'm ready for the event.
NPR Morning Edition. This is Mission Control Houston. Please call Station for a voice check.
Station, this is Leila Faldin with NPR's Morning Edition. How do you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear. Welcome to the International Space Station.
It's the latest chapter in a pretty remarkable career. It's also become somewhat of a lighthearted joke turned viral meme among other Asian Americans who see Kim as an Asian American mom's dream. Kim is a self-described private person, so I ask him what it's been like to be the subject of these viral memes.
You know, it's lighthearted, it's fun. I don't take it too seriously. But I do think, though, that there's perhaps some value that's lost in even lighthearted tropes or stereotypes like that. And one of our jobs as astronauts is that human connection. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. The world could use so many more stories of vulnerability and failure and growth and redemption. And sometimes, you know, I wonder if just some of those memes and jokes kind of lose sight or kind of condense a story that I think everyone can relate to of struggle, of growth, and into a one-liner. So, you know, I think it's funny, but sometimes I wonder if that's the right story that we really need to be hearing today.
What would you want people to know that's beyond this joke? What were the struggles along the way that you would want people to know about?
Having the confidence in finding your identity is, I think, a voyage that everyone has to take. And believing in yourself and having dreams. You know, I think the ability to dream is one of the most important things we need to do. Oftentimes we talk about inspiration and hard work, and those are absolutely very, very important. But it always starts with a dream. And sometimes, well, not sometimes, there's a lot of people out there who don't have those dreams, either because they're born in unfortunate situations or they're facing challenges or they're going through mental health challenges. I mean, there's just so much struggle in the world. And I think it's important to recognize that we oftentimes are all having our own internal battles and to never, ever sell yourself short. That's like, for me, one of the biggest things that I've learned along my journey is that there are always going to be glass ceilings in the world, everywhere. That's never going to change. But the one glass ceiling you can never break through is the one that you set on yourself. And oftentimes, I think the lowest glass ceiling that a lot of us have is the one we set on ourselves.
Kim didn't know what he was going to be as an adult, and he didn't imagine three different careers, but he had a clear motivator, the drive to serve others.
You know, I certainly didn't have any of that journey planned. Since being a young boy, I've always been really, really drawn to wanting to make a difference. And I think we all kind of look for meaning or how to derive value in each of our own lives in our own way. And during my time in the SEAL teams, I became really passionate about this idea of helping people in a really direct way. And that drew me into medicine, especially because I had some experiences as a combat medic overseas. And I really just dived into it and saw a lot of the benefit I was able to do. And it touched me in a way that made me feel I could do that for the rest of my life. Being an astronaut was really never on my radar. It was something that I kind of accidentally stumbled upon. But when I had the seed planted, I realized that a lot of the same motivations for my desire to be in the military or to be a physician, which was to make a positive impact, they were completely consistent with that idea. And so the idea of being aboard the International Space Station, showing our science, our research, technology demonstrations, but most importantly, making that human connection, that is able to inspire people on a scale that I think makes a positive difference in our world.
So you're talking to us from aboard the International Space Station. What are you working on?
There's a lot of things we work on each day. You know, I kind of divide a lot of the things that we do on a daily basis as science and research, technology demonstrations, but also a lot of maintenance. The International Space Station is a national lab, but it's also our home. And just like in any home, things break. The toilet might stop working or their air conditioning might be a little ratty. And so a lot of times we are maintaining our home. From the science perspective, the hope is that a lot of the research we do here enables us to venture further for deep space exploration for these multi-year missions, whether they're to the moon and Mars. And in order to do that safe and successfully, we need to know as much about how the human body reacts to microgravity.
Your kids must think this is so cool that you're in space.
No, they're actually quite over it. But, you know, I think that's healthy. My son's just asking me when I can play video games with him again. And so kids are kids, but I'm so proud of them. And I know they're proud of me.
And really quick, what's next? The moon, Mars?
I'm very passionate about public service. And one of the reasons why I love NASA and our international collaboration, it's a way for me to work with one of the large collections of public service workers. And so I want to just keep doing what I'm doing here. No specific intentions or plans, but we'll see where this voyage takes us.
That's Johnny Kim. He's currently on an 8-month mission in space aboard the International Space Station. Johnny, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and goodbye from the International Space Station.
Bye. That is so cool. Johnny just literally floated out of frame. This is NPR News.
Damon Young says the Black American writers he included in his new anthology have a sense of humor unique to their experience as Black Americans.
That sort of clarity, that sort of honesty, that sort of like reckoning, the best humor comes from that.
I'm Juana Summers, Young's new anthology on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from the NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says the massive tax cut and spending package will increase funding for immigration and customs enforcement and create more detention centers for people living in the country illegally. Speaking to reporters, Johnson pointed to an Egyptian national who was charged with attacking demonstrators in Boulder, Colorado last weekend.
It isn't about Palestine. It isn't about Gaza. It isn't about any particular conflict. It's because these people want a complete and total extermination of the Jewish people.
The bill is being reviewed by the Senate. Several Republicans have said they won't vote for the measure in its current form. President Trump's tariff increases on imported steel and aluminum are now in effect. NPR's Marie Andrusovich reports Trump signed an executive order on Tuesday, raising the duties from 25% to 50%.
Calling the move a big jolt of great news for steelworkers, Trump says the tariffs will strengthen the U.S. steel industry and protect jobs while eliminating what he says is the national security threat of imports. Canada is the number one exporter of steel to the U.S. In a statement to CTV News, the Prime Minister's office said it was engaged in intensive negotiations to have the tariffs removed, calling them unlawful and unjustified.
That's NPR's Marie Andrusovich reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 29 points. This is NPR News. The newly elected president of South Korea is pledging to reunite a politically polarized nation and pursue pragmatic foreign policies. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports snap elections were held to replace the former president, who was impeached for illegally imposing martial law.
Lee Jae-myung delivered his inaugural speech in parliament. He promised to restore peace, security, livelihoods, and a democracy damaged by martial law. He beat his conservative rival 49% to 41%. Voter turnout was 71%, the highest since 1997. The White House called South Korea's election free and fair, but added that the U.S. is concerned and opposed to Chinese interference and influence in democracies around the world. Conspiracy theorists, including Steve Bannon and Laura Loomer, have also hinted at Chinese meddling in the election, but like the White House, have offered no evidence. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
A new wave of cyber attacks has hit several major companies in the U.S. Clothing retailer Victoria's Secret and upscale jewelry maker Cartier have reported breaches within the last week. Officials say internal systems were compromised, triggering security lockdowns and ongoing investigation. So far, there have been no confirmed leaks of customer data. Stocks are trading higher on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow up 32 points, the Nasdaq up 54. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG. Our purpose is people. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. A key piece of evidence in the trial of Sean Combs is a hotel surveillance video. It shows a violent confrontation between Combs and his girlfriend at the time. Jurors have seen that event from more than one angle. There's more than one video. The event has come up in testimony of multiple witnesses. And now another witness has testified about it, saying that Combs paid him in order to get his hands on the footage. We should advise you this story mentions violence and sex. Lasts about 3.5 more minutes. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has been in the courthouse and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, for those who have not seen it, it's been all over the place. What's on this video?
So the hotel video is from 2016, and it shows Combs hitting, kicking, and dragging his ex-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura, who is probably the highest profile witness in this case. Last year, CNN obtained and released a version of the video, and it became public after Ventura had filed and settled a civil lawsuit against Combs, but before he was indicted on these criminal charges. Just as a reminder, those charges include sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. Combs has pleaded not guilty to all the charges.
Right, of course. Now, it's interesting that this witness is talking not strictly about what happened on the video, but about the handling of the video afterward. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
That's correct. So one of the things that we learned is that Combs knew this video was a potentially damning piece of evidence, even dating right back to when this happened. So it was a witness named Eddie Garcia. He worked for security at the hotel. And he told the court that hours after the assault, the security desk received multiple calls from a woman named Christina Corum. She worked for Combs, and she repeatedly asked for the footage, even at one point showing up to the hotel. She would put Combs on the line. They got a hold of Garcia's personal phone number. And they promised that if he made the video go away, they would, quote, take care of him. According to Garcia, he told his boss what was going on. And his boss offered to give Combs the footage in exchange for $50,000.
Oh, offered to give him the footage for $50,000. What actually happened?
So Garcia told the court that his boss gave him a USB with the video, and then he went to meet with Combs, who had two of his employees with him. Remember, this video shows Combs beating Ventura and throwing her on the ground. And Garcia says he was really worried about what would happen if she went to the police. Combs allegedly called Ventura on FaceTime and told her to say that she also wanted this video to go away, which she did. Then Garcia said he signed a non-disclosure agreement and a document stating that this was the only existing copy of the video, and that then Combs gave him $100,000 in cash.
Okay, so the payment was made to make the video go away, but it hasn't gone away. CNN released it last year. I guess it wasn't the only copy?
Right, and Garcia said that he learned another version existed the same way we did when it was all over the news last year. It's unclear how CNN got that footage, but we do know that at least another copy of it exists in the world because another witness who worked at the hotel testified earlier in the trial, and he said that he recorded the footage onto his personal cell phone.
Okay, so we get all this testimony about Combs' concern about the video, showing Combs' concern about the video to the extent mm-hmm. he wanted to pay to make it go away. Did the defense attorneys challenge any of that testimony?
So, not really. Most of what the defense focused on was the technical details of that non-disclosure agreement that Garcia signed, but they did not try to poke holes into his claims of bribery. And interestingly, we saw something similar with another witness. She was an employee of Combs who testified that Combs physically and sexually assaulted her. And she said that in 2023, years after she no longer worked for Combs, a security guard contacted her to offer her an unsolicited gift. This was right after Cassie Ventura had filed her civil lawsuit against Combs. As with the hotel employee, the defense attorney didn't really challenge the witness's bribery accusations, but they went really hard after her allegations of sexual assault. So much so that the prosecution objected to their tone of the questions, and things got pretty confrontational.
NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, thanks for the reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
World Pride is underway here in Washington, D.C. The international festival celebrating all things LGBTQ has taken place in Copenhagen, London, and Sydney. But as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, attendance and sponsorships are down this year.
World Pride D.C. has been going on since mid-May. Ryan Boss, executive director of Capital Pride Alliance, says they've organized some 300 events across the city, dance parties, a film festival, family activities like Drag Story Hour, and events for military personnel. But Boss says the Trump administration's anti-drag and trans policies and rhetoric have had a chilling effect.
A lot of our service members are being forced back in the closet because they're afraid of being who they are at their work, and that is just extremely disheartening.
People from around the world travel to World Pride festivals, but this year, Boss says, hotel bookings are below what they were expecting. Sponsorships are also down. Past DC Pride sponsors, including Booz Allen Hamilton and Comcast, didn't come back this year. They did not return NPR's request for comment.
Companies, I think, overall are in a very tough spot.
Luke Hartig is president of Gravity Research, which recently surveyed roughly 200 Fortune 1000 companies about their Pride sponsorships. He says more than a third of them plan to decrease their Pride support this year. Many of them do business with the federal government.
Federal contractors are in a particularly precarious place when it comes to Pride, because Pride is so closely integrated into broader DEI efforts. And when it comes to the administration's power to regulate DEI in the private sector, their powers are probably at their greatest when it comes to federal contractors. And I think for a lot of companies, celebrating Pride just comes a little too close to the danger zone.
Pride festivals are by their nature political. Rick Andre, who's based in Switzerland, is the co-president of InterPride, World Pride's umbrella organization.
With World Pride coming to D.C., it does give a strong impression to the administration that, you know, we're not going to be silent about the rights that are being taken away. We're going to do our best to support our community as best as possible.
That community includes the more than 250 singers in the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington. The chorus was scheduled to perform at the Kennedy Center with the National Symphony Orchestra in May during World Pride. But shortly after President Trump announced he would take over the institution, the chorus was informed the event would not take place. The orchestra told NPR the concert was postponed for financial and scheduling reasons, not because it was a Pride event. Thea Kano, artistic director of the chorus, says it was disappointing.
You know, nobody wants to be canceled or feel like they've been canceled. But that's why right away we thought, well, we cannot be silenced. Music is our protest. We are resilient.
Gay Men's Chorus of Washington organized an international choral festival for World Pride. The organization says some choirs from abroad pulled out because of the tension in Washington. A big closing ceremony for World Pride DC takes place this weekend. There's a parade and concerts featuring Jennifer Lopez, Cynthia Erivo, and Doechii. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Hello, I'm Scott Tong. Here and Now brings you the latest news from around the country. So hear the news as it develops on the next Here and Now from NPR News.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Cockatoos in Australia have a new watering hole. Water fountains, once meant for humans. They use their claws to twist the handle. Scientists don't know why cockatoos are going out of their way when they can find water elsewhere, but the leading hypothesis is water fountains are more fun. The cockatoos have also been seen opening lids of garbage cans. Just wait until they learn how to turn on a car. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Republicans are not done debating the budget bill they're trying to pass through Congress. Some senators say this bill adds too much to the federal deficit. It increases rather than reduces federal borrowing. Others worry about cuts to Medicaid, among other things. Some lawmakers have raised concerns about other provisions, including one touching the regulation of artificial intelligence. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram is covering that. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so in theory, this is a budget bill. It's about spending rates, but there's this provision about AI. What does it say?
Yeah, it's kind of tucked away in this really big bill. And it says that most laws that states have passed in regards to AI protections, the federal government would step in and pause enforcement on those laws for 10 years.
When I first heard this, I just wondered, is there any chance that, you know, a chatbot got in there and just kind of made that change to the legislation?
I don't think so, because I think it did pass the House, Steve. It got approved. So it's real.
Got it. Well, what are some of the laws that would be paused for an entire decade?
There's an example that's pretty prominent in Tennessee. They passed what's called the Elvis Act, which protects people like musicians against AI recreations of their voice. Hmm. Another interesting one is in Utah. There's a law that protects consumers when it comes to chatting with AI mental health chatbots. And half the states in the U.S. have laws that protect against deepfakes in election materials. And there's, you know, a ton of other examples. But the thing to keep in mind is that states have really had to step in and take it upon themselves to pass their own AI laws, because Congress hasn't passed any federal regulation when it comes to AI, despite working on it for years. So that's why states have stepped in on their own and created this patchwork, right? And that's one of the main reasons many Republicans want to intervene here. They say that state laws aren't uniform and that inconsistency hurts businesses and tech companies.
Okay, so that's their explanation. Can't do it patchwork state by state. They are, in this case, unlike some others, not in favor of a state by state sort of laboratory of ideas. Mm-hmm. What does the White House think of this provision?
So I reached out to the Office of Science and Technology at the White House. They declined to comment, but remember that this is a White House that has a lot of players who are close to or have long worked in the tech sector. President Trump has been really clear that he wants there to be very few roadblocks for AI companies, and that's in line with what some Republicans are arguing here. They don't want anything to hamper AI innovation because they say the U.S. is trying to compete with China. But J.B. Branch, who works at the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, I talked to him and he says consumers need some protections.
This is just appeasement to big tech with a giant bow on it. Whatever Congress comes out with isn't going to be perfect. Not everyone's going to love it. That's how it works. But to say that we're going to rip away any protections while we kind of try to get our act together is recklessly irresponsible.
And Branch says that AI innovation in the U.S. is already happening, right? And cutting out state protections would mean that there'd be no rules curbing these tech companies.
Okay, you said this already passed the House. How likely is it to also pass the Senate?
It gets a little bit wonky here, so stick with me. For Republicans to be able to pass this big bill on their own, there's a special Senate rule that says that all provisions have to be directly tied to the budget. And this provision on AI isn't budget related, it's policy related. And, you know, there's some really vocal Republicans who are opposed. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, just yesterday, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene said she didn't know that the provision was in the bill when she voted for it, but she won't support the final version. But keep in mind, Steve, you know, even if this gets scrapped from this bill, that doesn't mean that the idea of stripping away states' AI laws is completely dead, because Texas Senator Ted Cruz has said that he would put it forward in a new package.
Deepa Shivaram, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Another donor to President Trump's election campaigns is expected to be confirmed by the Senate for a leadership role in his administration. Michael Boren, an Idaho software developer and rancher, is in line to oversee the Forest Service, an agency he has frequently argued with. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports.
If confirmed as U.S. Agriculture Undersecretary, Michael Boren would supervise the Forest Service as it faces one of its biggest crises in modern times. Wildfires are getting more deadly and destructive due to climate change and a buildup of fuels from prior management decisions. And earlier this year, President Trump's DOGE eliminated thousands of positions at the agency. The president's proposed budget calls for even deeper cuts as summer fire season is well underway in the West. At a confirmation hearing yesterday, Boren sought to reassure Senate Democrats.
I have not had an experience with the Forest Service yet where I understand what the staffing levels are and how they're being applied, but I am very familiar with resource-constrained organizations, having worked in one and for one.
Boren founded a Boise software company with his brother that's now worth $6.5 billion. In Idaho lately, he's mostly in the headlines for clashes with the Forest Service around a large ranch he owns in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. He's been accused of flying a chopper close to an agency trail crew and fought legal battles over an airstrip he built for private planes to access his ranch.
As a landowner, I have had disagreements from time to time with the Forest Service. Typically, they've been very aggressive at the beginning of those disagreements.
Boren said he and the agency have always talked things through and found solutions. But some of his neighbors tell a different story. In the West right now, there are growing tensions over an influx of ultra-wealthy landowners. In the mountain town of Stanley, longtime environmental activist John Marvel says Boren's appointment to oversee the Forest Service is ironic.
But it's not surprising in light of the general attitudes in the current administration, where they've turned against public lands as a positive value for the American people.
Boren told the committee he'd fight for everyone to have access to public lands. When asked if he'd recuse himself from any Forest Service decision that affected him, Boren promised he'd follow the advice of Agriculture Department ethics attorneys. His nomination has not yet advanced to the full Senate for a confirmation vote. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
Long before K-pop took off, it was South Korea's classical musicians who were rocking the music world. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports on an historic Italian opera house that's been around for nearly 2.5 centuries and has chosen a Korean maestro to lead it for the first time.
Milan's Teatro alla Scala announced that renowned conductor Chong Myung-hoon will take over in 2027 and serve as music director until 2030. Chong is the second youngest of seven kids in a prodigiously musical family. He made his public debut as a pianist at age 7. At 8, he moved to the U.S. In 1969, he performed in a Rensky piano trio on The Ed Sullivan Show with his two diva-esque sisters, violinist Chong Kyung-hwa and cellist Chong Myung-hwa. Chong Myung-hoon studied conducting at the Juilliard School in New York in the 1970s. In a statement, La Scala described Chong as one of the most beloved artists among the Milanese public. Since 1989, Chong has conducted 141 concerts with La Scala. Chong told a recent press conference in Busan about his new job. It feels like getting married, he said, after loving each other for 36 years. Chong says he's especially fond of Giuseppe Verdi's operas, several of which debuted at La Scala.
There are two operas that I particularly love. One is Don Carlo. And the other one is Simon Boccanegra. This Simon Boccanegra is a personal favorite, particularly because of the title character. Boccanegra, who embodies what a great man should be, the generosity, the warmth that comes through.
Since Chong Myung-hoon's rise to fame, younger South Korean musicians have claimed an outsized share of prizes in international competition. Shin Soo-jong is professor emeritus at Seoul National University, a pianist and friend of Chong Myung-hoon's family. She sees three key ingredients behind South Korea's success.
Number one,
Korean folk, they have really artistic temperament, improvisation and an expression of feeling and that kind of thing. And then number two is there's always supporting parents, especially mother.
And the third thing is South Korea's growing economic clout, which has enabled young talents to study overseas. After decades of performing in Europe, Chung Myung-hoon returned to Korea in 2005 and focused on fostering new talent and musical exchanges. He says he admires maestros like Verdi for their contributions to humanitarian causes.
His greatest work was that before he died and many years before, he prepared a retirement home for musicians, which he built in Milan. And he dedicated all his royalties to this place.
Chung notes that Koreans and Italians have a lot in common, how they express their emotions, their love of singing. Both live on peninsulas jutting off the Eurasian landmass. For centuries before 1871, Italy was a divided nation. Korea was divided in 1945 and still is. Italy's reunification had a sort of unofficial anthem, Giuseppe Verdi's opera Nabucco, which premiered at La Scala in 1842. Chung Myung-hoon has conducted its famous aria, Va Pensiero. Chung Myung-hoon's humanitarian cause has been to reunify North and South through music. His concerts have raised money for North Korean children. In 2017, he created the One Korea Orchestra. But for now, ties between the two Koreas are in a deep freeze, and the prospect of Chung Myung-hoon conducting an inter-Korean orchestra seems distant. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Busan.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.